Hello and welcome to the Soccer History USA podcast. On today's episode, Gil Heron. On the last episode of the podcast, I talked about or raised the question about who was the first professional black soccer player in the United States. And so in today's episode, I want to answer that question by talking about the career of Gil Heron, the man who I think has the best claim to being the earliest known professional black soccer player in the United States. Gilbert St. Elmo Heron was born in Kingston, Jamaica on April 9, 1922. Both his parents were black, but his great-great-grandfather had come from Scotland. While a schoolboy on the island, Heron played soccer, of course, ran track, and supposedly in a quarter-mile race once beat the legendary Herb McKinley, who as a sprinter would go on to win a gold medal in the as part of the 4x100 relay team in the 1952 Olympics. And as we'll see, speed would always be an important part of Gil Heron's soccer game as well. In 1939, he arrived in the United States with his mother after his parents had split up. And at first they settled in Cleveland. And while he was there, he played American football. He played what we today might call running back for the Glenville High School Tar Blooders. And he seemed to be pretty talented. And in fact, reports indicate that they were designing plays especially for him. But unfortunately, he broke his shoulder partway through the season, and that was the end of his nascent American football career. But I think it illustrates something, and again, we'll touch on this at various points, that he was a talented athlete playing soccer, playing baseball. There's even some record of him having boxed as well. Eventually, the family moved to Detroit, and Detroit would really be Heron's hometown from this point on. In 1943, he enlisted in the Canadian Air Force because, of course, he was still a British citizen at that point. He didn't see any action overseas during World War II, and it seems from the evidence that I could gather that he mostly spent the war playing sports. So again, he boxed, he ran track, and he played shortstop for the softball team at the base that where he was stationed. And of course, he also played soccer, again, revealing his overall athleticism. He was hospitalized in October 1943 with a serious knee injury that he suffered in a soccer game against a Norwegian Air Force team. By June 1944, he had been discharged from the Air Force and he returned to Detroit. A year later or so, he had continued to play soccer and he was playing for a team called Venedia in the Detroit District Soccer League. This was an amateur circuit and he scored 44 goals in just 14 games, which if you average that out is over a hat trick per game. He was, by this point, 6 feet tall, about 170 pounds, with a light brown complexion and reddish hair and hazel green eyes. I want to pause here to talk a little bit about Chicago, because it's in Chicago where Heron would play arguably his best soccer and where he would make his first appearance as a professional.
Chicago is next.
Soccer in Chicago had a history dating back to at least the late 19th century. First, it was played mostly by British immigrants and later by Eastern European immigrants as well. League play began as early as the 1880s, so Chicago had always had a strong soccer tradition. In 1909, the Peel Cup, named for an Irish-American, was organized. It's a state competition that was deliberately modeled after the England's FA Cup. In 1913, a high school soccer league existed, and it also included one of the first known black players, a student named Marvell Webb, who turned out for his school in 1916. In the 1920s and 30s was the period of real growth in soccer in Chicago. There were intense rivalries being formed, especially between Eastern European clubs, organized by folks who had come from Czechoslovakia and Poland. And they competed not only on the field, but they also competed for the top players some of whom were signed directly from Europe. They were brought over to play soccer from Poland or Czechoslovakia or other areas. These clubs had corporate backers who paid or financed for these, what we might call transfers, but also helped to pay the wages of these players that were brought in to turn out for the clubs. Unlike the case of New York, which I talked about in a previous podcast, I could find no evidence of any black soccer clubs in Chicago, despite the fact that the African-American population was steadily increasing over the course of a few decades. In 1910, for instance, the population was about 44,000. By 1920, the African-American residents in the city numbered nearly 110,000. And by 1930, the number had grown to around 234,000. So part of what's called the Great Migrations of African Americans from primarily the American South into urban areas, especially places like Chicago, Detroit, and New York. We do see that, as in the case of New York, soccer as a sport, as an organized sport, seemed to be less restrictive in terms of racial segregation and discrimination than many other institutions and activities that were performed or that took place in the city. So I already talked about Webb, the high school student who played for his local league. In the 1920s and 30s, a group called the Labor Sport Union, which was associated with trade unions as well as the Socialist and Communist parties, they called for integrated sports, and they especially wanted to highlight opportunities for African Americans to participate in sports of all kinds. In 1934, or by 1934, they had a soccer league that had 13 teams in two divisions. But it's unclear whether or not there were any African Americans participating in this league. But nonetheless, this was a stated goal of the league, was to try to improve opportunities for black athletes in the city. The Chicago Defender, of course, one of the largest and most famous newspapers, African American newspapers in the United States, didn't cover soccer a tremendous amount, but they did write articles and publish photographs when the Uruguayan team visited, and they praised Andrade, the Afro-Argentine fullback who starred for the national team. And they also reported on scores for historically black colleges, soccer clubs like Hampton, Howard, and Lincoln. So not a tremendous amount of coverage for soccer in the black press, but at least some awareness of it. Also in the 1930s, a Mexican club, Necaxa, formed, and although many of the Mexican immigrants would have preferred to play baseball, the organized baseball associations in the city prohibited or discriminated against Mexicans and would not allow them to participate. And so they formed a soccer club and joined the National Soccer League, where they were allowed to compete against white clubs. So we can see that soccer at least had the potential for greater African-American participation than was possible in many other sports, including baseball. In 1946, the Hungarian-born restaurant captain, Fred Weitzman, who had owned a team called the Chicago Maroons, a soccer team called the Maroons, wanted to join the American Soccer League. And the folks at the ASL said, well, why don't you form a Western division? And instead, Weitzman decided that he was going to form his own professional league and called it the North American Soccer League, not to be confused with the later iteration in the 1970s. This is also sometimes called the North American Professional Soccer Football League, which is something of a mouthful. The NASL included teams from Chicago, of course, but also Pittsburgh, Toronto, and a team from Detroit called the Wolverines. And starring on the Wolverines was a forward, the 24-year-old Gil Heron. In June, on June 7th, 1946, Heron made his first appearance for the Wolverines in the league, and this probably marks the first, the debut of the first black known black professional soccer player in U.S. history, June 7th, 1946. And Heron would go on to be one of the league's best and most exciting players. Just some highlights of that first season in the NASL. He scored a hat trick in the first league game played at Comiskey Park in Chicago, and he also scored in the game that clinched the league title for Detroit. Overall, he finished the season with between 14 and 16 goals. The sources differ on exactly how many he scored in just 8 games, and he emerged winning the Golden Boot as the league's top scorer for that season. The next year, he was acquired by the Chicago Maroons for what was called at the time a substantial sum, and he was going to be paid $25 a game, which is the same sum that he earned for the Wolverines the previous year. The 1947 season was not nearly as successful for the league or for Heron, and it would be abandoned by the fall of 1947. And Heron had scored only 4 goals in the 10 games that had been played to that point. So despite the fact that the 1947 season was perhaps not as successful as his debut in the league the year before, nonetheless, the black press had recognized the accomplishments of Heron and celebrated his appearance. I mean, this is the period where Jackie Robinson had signed for the Brooklyn Dodgers, was playing in the minor leagues, and would make his pro debut just under a year after, or just about, just less than a year after Heron made his a debut appearance as a professional soccer player. Robinson would play his first game for the Dodgers in April 1947. Ebony Magazine published a spread on Heron in 1947 and called him the Babe Ruth of soccer. And a year later, the Chicago Defender would call him, quote, the only member of his race playing in pro circles. So clearly, even though they didn't spend a lot of time talking about soccer, the black press recognized this as a significant achievement and recognized and championed Heron for his skill and ability on the pitch. After the failure of the NASL, Heron stayed in Chicago, and he lived in the famous Bronzeville section of the city near the Regal Theater, which was kind of the heart of a black culture and society during that particular period. In 1948, he married Bobby Scott, who he met at a bowling alley near the factory where they both worked. And although the marriage was short-lived, they did have a son who went on to great fame as the poet and musician Gil Scott Heron. In that same year, 1948, he signed for Sparta, which was one of the Eastern European clubs that had one of the probably the most successful and powerful of the Eastern European clubs. And he played outdoor soccer in what was called the National Soccer League, and he also played indoor soccer. And interestingly enough, many of these games were televised on local television, including the indoor soccer league games. And so they mark some of the first televised soccer games in U.S. history. With Sparta, he continued his prolific goal scoring. He netted 38 in just 16 games, including 4 in a 7-0 rout of Hansas. And in that particular match, he scored 2 goals in the first 8 minutes. Heron became a U.S. citizen in 1949, and also in that summer, he played on a city all-star team and scored against what was essentially the U.S. men's national team in their in matches that were preparing for qualifying for the World Cup, the 1950 World Cup. And he, scoring and playing in that match, put on a good performance against many of the same men who would later be in the U.S. squad that would defeat England famously in that World Cup 1950. Despite scoring 12 goals that season, he soon hung up his boots and returned to Detroit. It seems that the team, Sparta, had signed a foreign striker and perhaps had no need or didn't wish to continue to pay top wages for more than one forward. He spent the last few years of his career in Scotland. In 1951, he became well known as the first black player to turn out for Celtic. But while there, he had few opportunities with the first team and spent most of the year in the reserves. Later, he moved on to Third Lanark, another Scottish club, but again spent most of his time there playing for the reserves, and eventually ended up at lower league Kidderminster Harriers before returning to the United States. Also in 1952, in February, he earned two caps for Jamaica and scored a brace against the Caribbean All-Star team, marking his only appearances for the national team. After returning to the United States with his Scottish wife, he lived in Detroit and worked as a photographer and started a second family. He died in 2008 and was probably remembered more in the United Kingdom than he is over here, in part because of his brief period with Celtic. And of course, he has been overshadowed by his more famous son, despite the fact that they were largely estranged from each other and would only meet in 1975. Meet again, I suppose I should say, in 1975. I don't think, though, that Heron should be remembered for his failures, either as a pro in the United Kingdom or as a father. But instead, his legacy should be as a prolific goal scorer, one of the most talented footballers of his era, and as the first professional black soccer player in U.S. history. Thank you for listening to the Soccer History USA podcast. For episode notes, please visit the website at www.soccerhistoryusa.org and follow me on Twitter at @SoccerHistoryUS.
I'm a free man. Looks like the time I've been changed.